You're listening to an Earth Day special of Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about the struggle for a Green New Deal. We talked a lot about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's vision for this and how we actually overcome capitalism and bring back energy. We're going to start talking a little bit more specifically about what's happening here in New York City and the struggle here to get a Green New Deal. And so one of the things that we're facing is, even though that we ban fracking here in New York, New York is still expanding frack gas infrastructure. So on Thursday of last week, there were over 500 people that marched across the Brooklyn Bridge to call on Governor Cuomo to stop the Williams pipeline. We're going to go to some sound from that march and rally, and here it is.
For anybody who doesn't know, we did not lose at Stony Rock. We were only seeds to spread across the world, and we have only just begun. There are $63 billion we divested from fossil fuel, and we've only just begun. You need to hold your politicians accountable.
That's right.
I ask you, when did we become the people who waited for the politicians to tell us what to do? When did we become the people who waited for somebody to feed us? When did we become the people who had to have rules, policies, laws, and codes for us? We empower ourselves. It is the people who should have always had the power, continue to have the power. This United States is supposed to be the people, not a government entity.
That's right. That's right.
When did you become a fascist nation?
You know what I'm saying?
Stand up.
Yes.
For your rights.
Stand up for first, the first medicine of the world, the water. Mini Wachoni, water is life.
Governor, you don't get to say you banned frack gas while allowing frack gas to pass through this state. You don't get to say you banned frack gas, but when I was in Albany running for lieutenant governor, I stood in front of a place he wanted to build a frack gas plant.
Come on, tell us,
Governor, we are at a time when your words are not enough. We have to see action.
We are here today because Williams Transco wants to build a 23-mile pipeline to bring frack gas all the way from Pennsylvania to the Rockies. Is of course meant to be burned and would release even more greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere, contributing to climate change. We are already in a climate emergency. We are already only have 11 years left. We should reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, getting off of all fossil fuels and turning to renewable energy before building more fossil fuel infrastructure.
Governor Cuomo's acting way too slow.
Williams Pipeline got to go.
Cuomo's acting way too slow.
Williams Pipeline got to go.
He said Cuomo's acting way too slow.
Williams Pipeline got to go.
That was LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who is one of the founding members of Standing Rock, the opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline, our public advocate, Jemani Williams, and 13-year-old climate activist and striker Alexandria Villasenor at a rally and march against the Williams Pipeline that happened last week here in New York City. The march was to call on Governor Cuomo and the Department of Environmental Conservation to stop the Williams Pipeline. This pipeline will bring frack gas from Pennsylvania into New York, and Governor Cuomo and the DEC have until May 16th to make a decision on that pipeline. And around this time a year ago, on April 23rd, there were 55 people arrested outside of Governor Cuomo's door demanding that he stop frack gas infrastructure. He locked his doors on people and had people arrested, even though he, you know, talks a big game on climate change. And pretty much his big Earth Day announcement last year was, oh, we're going to ban plastic bags. A year later, that finally looks like it's going to happen, but it's not really, you know, the change that we need here in New York. I mean, obviously, it's a big first step, but, you know, banning plastic bags while building more frack gas pipelines and power plants isn't really where we need to be going.
Hey, Lee, what are plastic bags made out of?
They're made out of frack gas and fracked oil.
Oh, that's so weird, huh?
So I guess they'll just have to shift into a new product.
Exactly. But it's, you know, these kind of exactly what we were talking about earlier, these very market solutions, very much, you know, things that aren't actually addressing the systematic problems. And I think what's really cool these days, too, is that we see a lot of people, you know, AOC was actually really inspired to run for office because she went out to Standing Rock. And so we're seeing, you know, as LaDonna Brave Bull said, these seeds that are kind of spreading everywhere. We're also, last week, there were over 60 people arrested outside of City Hall with the Extinction Rebellion. Sarah, how do you think this kind of escalation tactics fit into the bigger picture around climate change and a Green New Deal?
Well, I mean, speaking as someone who was at Standing Rock for a very short amount of time, I think that was an incredible moment, and you could even feel it in the air when you were there, that this was kind of a sea change of sorts, that things weren't going to be done the same way that they had been done before in regards to activism around the climate. I really feel like what, you know, activists at Standing Rock were trying to do, and I think in a lot of ways accomplished, was shift the paradigm around what we're talking about when we're talking about the climate and then about the looks like. I felt like it was almost a trial run in the creation of a new world, because it was kind of a decommodified zone. Indigenous people were leading in every aspect of life. It was considered like a prayer camp instead of just a resistance camp. And there was a real sense of community around all the people that were there. And to me, that wasn't just about that one issue. It was about saying, we can live this way. Like, if we can do it here, we can scale this to the point that we can do this everywhere. And I think that, you know, it was so there's a de-escalation of tactics on the one hand of getting more confrontational and more directly taking on, you know, people in power and companies that refuse to act and politicians that refuse to act. And I'm really heartened to see that becoming more and more of a thing. But I also think that it's, you know, escalation of tactics in just demanding more and demanding what up until this point has been considered impossible, and doing that by actually showing that, no, this is not just possible. We can do it right now.
And you're listening to our Earth Day special from Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI Radio in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about the struggle for Green New Deal, and more specifically right now, we're talking about how the struggle at Standing Rock really planted the seeds for kind of this a broader movement for a Green New Deal, but how really important it is to kind of, if having this eco-socialist perspective and bringing to the mainstream, like learning from these indigenous struggles, because they've really been on the front lines of climate change and ecological destruction, like far before we knew like what was happening in terms of like carbon polluting the atmosphere. Like their environment, their living conditions were eradicated by European colonialism, by U.S. genocide of Native Americans, that there was that they have been like on this front line for a long time, and they've developed these strategies and these tactics. And I think what you saw at Standing Rock was that like really coming to the surface, and people starting to recognize like how much we need to learn from these communities in this struggle if we want to build a world that's like around social need and decommodifying and democratizing our resources, as opposed to like domination of the resources by a few for an irrational constant need for growth and profit.
Yeah, and I think it's also very important to remember that this wasn't, you know, the West wasn't one end of sentence, close that chapter in the history book. I think one thing that was made very clear to me at Standing Rock was that the West was never one. We, you know, indigenous people are still having war raged upon them. That war often looks like environmental terrorism on you know, their communities. It looks like people having to drink poison water and breathe in poison air and not get adequate nutrition and food. And it's not a thing that just happened, but it's a thing that continues to happen and that they continue to struggle under. And so I think that it's not just, you know, I think that indigenous people, it's not just a group of people to learn from, but it's a group of people to let lead in this fight, because they have been suffering the worst effects of, as you say, colonialism and capitalism and the capitalist project since the very beginning. And I think that, you know, we want to, you know, it's said that, you know, you can imagine the end of the world before you can imagine the end of capitalism. I think one reason it's so important that indigenous people lead in this fight is because they actually do have a memory of what a post-capitalist or a pre-capitalist, way of life can look like. And they actually, like, still have those teachings and still have that knowledge alive in a lot of their communities. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, we talk a big game about, like, wanting to build socialism, wanting to build a decommodified way of life, but a lot of us don't actually know what that looks like. And that was, I think, the gift that Standing Rock gave to me, was I actually got to experience, even for just a couple days, what it was like to live in a place that wasn't capitalized, that capitalism didn't exist in that one little, you know, couple of miles that they had. It was everywhere else. It was in the helicopters flying over your head. It was in the snipers on the hill. But in that one little space you had, it wasn't commodified. There was, the commons was alive again. And I think that is like where some of the wisdom some of the wisdom of indigenous leaders really shines through on this issue.
And that pipeline ended up actually being built because President Trump, when he got in office, one of the very first things that he did was sign an executive order to push that pipeline through, even though the correct environmental impact studies had never been done, even though there was this incredible resistance. And that's actually now happening here to a certain extent in New York. That Trump signed an executive order that will try to take away states' rights to say no to pipelines, which could mean pipelines like the Williams Pipeline could get shoved through even if we say no to it. And in his speech about this, Trump particularly called out radical activists in New York who have stopped pipelines before. And I think why we're seeing, you know, not only from the federal government, this really big push, is because we are building power here in New York to stop fossil fuels. And I think the fossil fuel industry is really freaking out. So it's also not just on the federal level. We're also seeing our own utilities really pushing for this gas. National Grid is going to be the only one to buy the gas. But just last week, Con Edison came out and said that they were going to declare a moratorium if this pipeline isn't built. And National Grid has also said that they are going to declare a moratorium. And they're using these tactics because they do have kind of a monopoly now. You don't really have a choice about what utility you pick. And for them, declaring these moratoriums is really just holding, you know, our energy hostage.
Yeah. Yeah, they're holding us hostage. And, you know, one thing that I think is, you know, instructive from Standing Rock is that that pipeline was originally going to go past a white community just north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. And when people in that, you know, largely white community found out that that was going to happen, they petitioned and they lobbied and the pipeline got moved. And it was when it was going to be put through a Native American reservation and under, you know, certain sacred sites that, you know, those concerns weren't listened to and people didn't care. I think, you know, we see this kind of the violence of capitalism being first felt at kind of what is often perceived as the margins of society. You know, it's first felt upon, you know, indigenous people, the so-called, you know, I think we were talking about this earlier in the show, but, you know, sacrifice zones, you know, there's even a name for it of places and people that, you know, are kind of, you know, that's just collateral damage in the, you know, striving for a bigger and better market. But eventually that's going to, you know, that it's going to come close, you know, it's going to permeate all aspects of society eventually. So even if you think that this is an issue, you know, of you're like, oh, I don't have a pipeline near me, fracked gas is an issue for me, well, it will become an issue for you. And it's already an issue for lots of people all over this country and all over the world right now.
And I think, like what you're talking about with this monopoly aspect, I think this brings back the point we were having before about the free market and how, like, the supposed free market, and then you have these, like, monopoly corporations controlling your energy. So no one really has any choice in the matter. It's absurd. Like, they have the power here because people just accept this social reality. It's like, oh, these companies get to own this energy, even though they're not the workers who built those functions in the first place. And they also want to hold on to them because it's the basis of their power and their wealth, even though that like wealth is destroying the like social basis of society. So the way that like monopoly capital really just undermines like both like our democratic rights, our ability to make like be free, make choices, but also just undermines like the basis of the society we live in. It destroys our environments because it's completely geared to maintaining its power and wealth at all costs.
And it's kind of funny, too, because you have these companies like National Grid and Con Edison, when they give public comments about why they're building this, they always say, well, we believe in climate change. You know, the solutions just aren't here yet. I mean, we know that they're pushing back on that because those solutions, things like community solar, geothermal, air source heat pumps, they can't own that. So there's no future business model for them in renewables. But they're always pushing back saying, oh, we believe in climate science, you know, trying to be that rational kind of Republican guy that was at the town hall. You know, today I got an email from National Grid saying like,
me too.
Yeah, it's like ridiculous. Oh, no. Like, hey, happy Earth Day. Thanks for lowering your bills and saving energy. Meanwhile, they're trying to, you know, shove a frack gas power, a pipeline, you know, through New York Harbor, bringing in all this emissions, all this methane that we know contributes to climate change. You know, they're keep pushing this fossil fuel industry lie that natural gas is a bridge fuel, but they're trying to sell us like a safe cigarette. You know, they have the documents in their drawers that say this is bad for people, this is bad for the climate.
It reminds me of there was a commercial a couple Super Bowls ago where one of the car companies, either like Ford or GM, they used a speech from Martin Luther King Jr. like that was about like America and like freedom, and it was the speech, if you actually read the whole thing, he's critiquing the auto industry, and it's like a fiercely anti-capitalist, anti-consumerist like critique of society and how like these corporations like undervalue their workers and how they're poisoning our environment. And it's like this kind of like, it's very much this like sort of like liberal capitalist model where it's like, oh, we can do like I think like Beto O'Rourke was out today. Like, oh, I love when I buy this product. It makes me feel so good about myself. It's just like, it's like nonsense. Like it's completely hiding the reality of the horror that's going on, whether it's like exploitation in the workplace or with like, I mean, which is also happening with these companies, but also in addition, like they're destroying your environment and they're telling you that they're doing the right thing. It's just a complete facade.
Yeah, I love that email, Lee, you were saying. It's like, thank you for using less of our product. Why shouldn't I use your product? Oh, don't worry about it. It's fine. like, you know, thank you for turning off the light and not using as much gas. Like, well, wait, if I shouldn't use as much gas, why should we use it at all? Like, it's within it, there's just that inherent contradiction is just, even in that, is apparent.
And if people want to find out more about the fight to stop the Williams Pipeline, you can go to stopthewilliamspipeline.org. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, an Earth Day special on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we've been talking about the struggle for a Green New Deal, and we're about to get really into the nitty-gritty of what that could look like here in New York City. We'll be joined soon by Thomas Niles. But first, we are going to hear from a canvas from a newly launched campaign from the Eco-Socialist Working Group. This is from the Public Power Canvas.
Thank you for coming to the Public Power NYC campaign kickoff. Before we begin, can I get a quick show of hands? Who here has canvassed before? Thomas, do you want to give like an explanation of why we're out here today?
So we're out here today because Con Ed is trying to raise rates for next year. And we feel like this process is not a democratic process how it gets decided. This is done with suits behind closed doors. So we want to bring more people into this process. So with that is we want more public hearings. Today, we are not only bringing up awareness about this campaign and about an alternative vision of utilities, which is community-owned, community-run energy, we also are trying to get Kevin Parker, who is the state senator in this area, to sign on to our letter. He is the chair of the Environmental Committee, so we feel like getting him to sign on this letter is going to help us a lot.
All right, so when you get to the actual door, first things first is you have to knock on it. Take a few deep breaths. The first door is always the hardest. But have a nice, gentle knock. Something a little rhythmic. Make sure, you know, that they know you're not a cop. So, like, I don't know, make it your own. Mine is Super Mario Brothers. If you want to do Diddy, as long as it's Nintendo. No Halo theme songs. I don't know how you do that in Knock, but if you try, okay, fine.
My name is Alice Murphy, and I'm in the Central Brooklyn branch, pretty newly, and so the working group that I'm in is the Eco-Socialists.
And you said this was your first canvas. What about this campaign compelled you to get involved?
Part of it was kind of hearing the pitch for it. It seemed like a perfect way for like people's interests that you run into regularly to kind of cross over with Democratic Socialists. Ideals and principles. So, like, the fact that that this campaign, which just has to do with what could look like a small rate hike, actually also, like, is a step on a path towards publicly owned utility, I think was really compelling. And it also, in terms of getting involved with canvassing, it seemed like something that would be really just easy to talk to people about, because no one wants to pay more than they're paying for electricity. And like the amount of things that I learned in about 5 minutes about this that I felt like it would be good to pass on to people. It's really interesting. Plus I was canvassing in my neighborhood, and so that seemed doable.
Yeah. And why do you think canvassing and talking to your neighbors is important?
I mean, I think it just, it brings up that, you know, among the people you live around, you have these shared interests. This is a really clear one, because everyone in the area is paying rent, is paying for their utilities. And the fact that, like, you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes to make those things true. It's one of those things that feels like a fact of life, but that the more you get involved and realize that, like, as you speak to each person, that there is kind of a base for, like, a democratic way for this to run, and that, yeah, that it doesn't seem fair at all. Like, it's, as soon as you think about it for a few minutes, it's like, oh, like this doesn't make any sense the way that this is currently working. And I think, like, just like saying that sentence to enough people and having it kind of echoed back at you is like really empowering.
So that was a great clip from our Public Power Canvas out in Flatbush. Shout out to all our listeners there. You are listening to an Earth Day special from Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about the struggle for the Green New Deal, and specifically right now, the Public Power Canvas here in New York.
And now we are joined in the studio by Thomas Niles. Welcome, Thomas.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So before we kind of really dig into the Public Power NYC campaign, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, why you joined DSA, and what kind of work you've been doing with the Eco-Socialist Working Group?
I joined DSA after the capital T, the capital E election of Trump. I just felt like, I think like how Sarah said, that it wasn't enough just to sit on the sidelines. We were kind of watching this country eat itself alive. And so I felt like I had to give it a shot and see what I can do to organize. I'd been part of a lot of protests and marches before and tried to join other organizations, but always kind of felt in over my head a little bit. And so I sort of made a conscious effort to really stick it out with DSA and try to get over that discomfort level that I think a lot of new people coming into organization kind of feel, when it just sort of feels, everything feels overwhelming and you feel like, what can I add to this situation?
And so we just heard that clip from the canvassing on Sunday of last week. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that canvass was about and more about the Public Power campaign?
Yes. So that canvas was about, right now Con Ed is trying to raise rates in 2020. So there is basically a case that goes on throughout this year that kind of operates like a court case. And Con Ed is arguing in front of what's called the Public Service Commission to convince them why rates need to be raised. And this is a pretty undemocratic process. It's usually behind closed doors, suits in the room. You can be a party to the case. And then you can become involved in the case. But that itself is a very complicated process. So there is really no way for the public to have any say in something that affects everyone, which is just really immoral. So what we are trying to do right now is not only try to fight that rate hike, but also try to bring more people into the process by having more public hearings. Usually those public hearings happen way later in the process, and they happen during times and in locations that just don't work for people, conveniently don't work for people. And so we are calling on the Public Service Commission to have more hearings, earlier hearings in the process, in places that are easily accessible. So we've sent a letter to them, but they have not agreed to our demands. And so we are working on getting various organizations and politicians to sign on to this letter. And that canvas was specifically to get Kevin Parker, who is the state senator in that area of Flatbush, which is a very energy burdened area. And he also sits on the chair of the Energy Committee. So we are trying to convince him to sign on to this letter. And so far he has refused. So we have been petitioning people in his district to call on him to sign on to this letter.
Something that you like seem to bring up and that we've been talking about a lot here is the lack of democratic control over our resources in the utility sphere specifically. And like, what problems does that like lack of democracy lead to?
What that leads to basically is the crisis we're in now. The people that are in the driver's seat are a very small minority, and they are also a very rich minority that are not going to be affected as much by climate change as everyone else is. Basically, when the floods come, they have yachts they can just chill out on that we've all paid for. So like, they don't care. They're basically going to see how long they can run out this con, how long they can run out this scam.
Elon Musk's like moon base.
Basically, yes. I remember that was the whole fantasy of the 90s was the moon base, moon base, moon base. Got shocked by moon base. But yeah.
Sorry.
But yeah, so we feel like obviously the majority of people would rather have clean energy than have energy that is being profitable by a small minority of people. So like that's a very clear and easy decision if the majority of the people can make that decision. But right now we are barely allowed any access to even be in the room when these sort of decisions are being made.
And so right now the public power campaign is really focused on this rate hike. But what are some of the larger visions of, you know, what you have for an eco-socialist energy system here in New York City?
So our vision sort of comes down to 3 Ds, which are decarbonize, decommodify, and democratize. And so we hold those values very close into what a new energy system can look like, one that is not just morally just, but one that is necessary to rapidly get us to 100% renewables in time. So I think decarbonize is pretty obvious. Decommodify is we view energy as a right. And I think one of the reasons we're in this mess is there have been sort of market solutions, and they've tried to sort of funnel this thing that is a right that is so essential to human life through the logic of the market, which is kind of is what's gotten us to where we're at now. And then we have democratized. We feel like everyday people need to have a say in this energy because, as I said, the majority of people want renewable energy. It's the small minority that is still making money off this scam that we still need to be on dirty energy. They might say that, oh, we want to get renewables, but we've got to wait for the market forces to happen. But they're the ones causing these market forces. So it's almost like that cup with the ball. It's no matter how many times you try to pick the ball that has the cup under it, it's always never going to be there because it's always they're waiting on the market forces. And I'm also like a big history nerd. So I think back to like the New Deal and you had energy co-ops. So this is not like just a moral thing, feel goody of just like people can own their own energy, kumbaya. But this is like logistically necessary. You had the Tennessee Valley Authority and you didn't have energy down there for the longest time. And they tried to get funding down there and try to get corporations to put in the initial capital to build energy generation down there. But that wasn't happening. But the community down there was like, no, we need that. And so then they had the community fund this through energy co-ops. And then you had sort of the place that had no energy got a ton of energy rather quickly. And so like I sort of view that model as something that we need to kind of look back on and follow.
yeah, whenever I hear, getting back to your earlier point, like people talking about like market forces to deal with this situation, it's like, oh, why don't you smoke more cigarettes to deal with your lung cancer or something? It's like you want to solve the problem by repeating what you're doing beforehand. It just seems ridiculous. And what you're mentioning, like these energy co-ops and this like local ownership of energy, and yeah, it's not a utopian idea. It's something that exists now, has existed in the past. It tends to run more effectively, efficiently, for cheaper cost, delivers results better. Obviously, it's corrupted by the overall capitalist relations, so we need to deal with our other horrible exploitation in our society, but in of themselves are better than private ownership. We just heard from LA how they were able to actually put pressure and get these plants out of the way because they have some democratic control of their energy there. So you've kind of already been hinting at this, but how does like the work here in New York like fit into this bigger picture? Like how does this like kind of local energy democracy building that fit in with kind of this broad democratic movement for energy on a national and even international level with the Green New Deal?
So with the Green New Deal, something that I was really excited about it is that it calls for public ownership. But so much of the Green New Deal right now is like an idea and hopes and promises. And we've kind of see where hopes and promises go with there's no movement to back that up. So what we want right now is to build a movement of public ownership, because I feel like right now a lot of people don't even think of the grid as anything to be politicized. It's sort of just natural. It's the air we breathe. It's the water we swim in. They have no idea that this is a battle being waged right now. So if this is something that we want to have be an essential plank for the Green New Deal, we are going to have to start that fight now before the real battle for the Green New Deal begins, hopefully, fingers crossed, in 2020, when we have more electeds that are more likely to be supportive of this. So we really need to start putting teeth behind that demand now to make sure that is an essential plank and platform of the Green New Deal.
And what we're also seeing, too, is there was a hearing on Monday of last week on the Williams pipeline. Con Ed was there to push for the pipeline, even though they're not actually buying this gas, which is just proof that they're trying to fight for this system, you know, in their business model. And they specifically said, like, we want a bill passed so that we can own the solar. In the past, utilities have not been able to own solar in New York. And what they have been pushing for is this really insane policy called VITR. It was the brainchild of Richard Kaufman, who's a former Goldman Sachs guy, who was Cuomo's energy czar. And what that did was actually kind of suppress community solar, because they were trying to figure out this perfect market solution so that they could keep their business model alive. And it just made it so complicated that we lost $800 million of community solar and municipality solar last year. And now they're pivoting, saying, well, hey, you know, aren't we the best people to build this? You were in the audience. Like, well, how did it feel to hear kind of Con Ed pushing to own all the solar moving forward?
Well, I think that kind of goes back to the whole thing about them just being like, well, these are just the market forces in place. And so it's sort of like there's no blood on their hands because it's the market forces, but they are the ones actually making it through VITR and destroying community solar. So it's one way that the rates are kind of, and our rates are the second highest in the country, but one of the ways that rates are kind of kept down is that Con Ed does not own generation. And so they have to kind of go to the market and get the lowest rates for the generation. So they don't want that. They want to have as much horizontal integration as they can. And so if they own all that, then there's no really restrictions on the prices that they can set. And also, energy is going to be decentralized. And so instead of sort of like all of us collectively getting our power from like these massive like power plants, it's going to be these smaller solar plants. And so if you have Con Ed own all these distributed energy resources, you can have areas that they won't find profitable to kind of keep those areas up. So there might be areas in Brooklyn where it's just is not economically feasible for them to maintain the solar grid out there. So you could have stuff where like power in sort of areas almost become power deserts. If Con Ed is able to also own generation.
So you like it gets like integrated when you have market forces, like quote unquote market forces, which is really just capitalists exerting their power in society. They're always going to do things for their bottom line. And when you live in a society that is racist and is structured upon these in classes, that there will be areas like that won't be served by the energy because of like it's not profitable for them. That's while if you had community owned energy, everyone in the within that community would have, like, it's their actual livelihood is at stake, so they would want the energy system continually work. Like, they're personally invested in it, while the private owners don't really care at all about the people who they're quote unquote serving.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like I would trust my neighbors in my community a lot more because they're obviously not doing this just to make a buck off of it than some distant CEO saying, like, oh, we got to do this because of market forces and we got to make sure the shareholders are making sure they get their fair share. And that's like the bottom line right there.
And so this is one of the first really major campaigns that the Eco-Socialist Working Group is kind of bringing forth to New York City and to DSA in general. Can you talk just a little bit about how the first canvas went and kind of how it's been like to really shape this campaign? And I think one thing that's really cool is Public Power said, you know, Con Ed is your, like, energy landlord. And I think that's a really great way to think about this, that, you know, housing should be a human right and so should energy.
Yeah, so this is sort of the first campaign that the Eco-Socialist Group has been trying to build. And so that's been really exciting because we've got a lot of energy, no pun intended, coming into this campaign. So like I always say, if they build it, they will come. We very much want this to be a campaign that is built by our membership, because I feel like that is sort of the strength we have, is we have the strength of numbers. We have the strength of many minds from many backgrounds coming up to sort of brainstorm the solutions for this. Like you said, Con Ed is our energy landlord. That came out of one of the breakout groups that we had where people were just kind of like throwing around slogans, and that came up, and that was just genius. And we've been really sticking with that as a slogan. So we are very much about building this campaign together, because this is also obviously not going to be an easily won campaign over the next couple months. This is going to be something that is going to be a long slog. So we want this to be something that everyone has ownership in. And we also just want a lot of minds at the table, because we are going to have to react to really powerful forces. So we're going to need just a lot of solutions on the table to be able to figure this one out.
Yeah, what I think is, like, really impressive about this campaign and, like working for things like, you know, locally democratically controlled and run energy, is that you're creating, like, a working class institution that is opposed to the private power structure, that is opposed to capitalist institutions that are dominated from the top up. It's rather run democratically from the grassroots and gives a place for people to really realize socialism, like, in their actual life beyond an ideal. So, like, how do people get involved in this campaign if they really want to, like, pursue this sort of work to transform their society?
So we have a website that we just launched. We're building it day by day, but it's publicpower.nyc, and there is an option to get involved. We have canvases going on. We have our next canvas is going to be in Flatbush, and that's going to be next Sunday on the 28th from 2 to 5. We also have our next Eco-Socialist meeting, which will be discussing this campaign and building it there, and that is May 7th at Verso at 7 o'clock to 9. So those are the initial two first steps. I also just want to say that while we are building this campaign, this was not something that has been built in a vacuum. And this has been something that I have only been researching and learning over the past 2 years. But there are frontline communities that have been actively involved in this fight for a really long time. You have the Climate Justice Alliance, and they also have energy-focused campaigns called Our Power Coalitions that they have been building up across this country. And so a lot of the stuff I've learned about sort of how essential this whole process is to a just transition has been through reading from these groups and their writings and stuff like that.
Like, coming together, working in coalition with them, learning from them, because they've been on the front line of the struggle, is a really important part of the process, is what you're trying to get at.
Yes, totally.
Well, thank you so much, Thomas. You're listening to an Earth Day special of Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about the struggle for a Green New Deal, and in the last hour, we've really gotten down into what that could look like for New York City. And just last week on Thursday, a historic collection of bills was passed called the Climate Mobilization Act. And to talk about that a bit, we have climate reporter Alexander Kaufman with the Huffington Post. Alex, can you hear us?
I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for coming on. So
thanks for joining us, Alex.
So the Climate Mobilization Act will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2030. It's a whole bundle of bills. Could you break those down of us for a little bit about what's actually in those bills?
Sure. So it was a package of six bills, that all of which had already been introduced and had kind of begun to make their way through the legislative process. The big one, which is what you're referencing with the 40% reduction by 2030, is a duo of bills that help that mandate energy efficiency retrofits on buildings over 25,000 square feet, which overwhelmingly consume the majority of the city's energy and other resources. So these retrofits, which, you know, go as far as requiring replacements of insulation or new windows and things of that nature, really actually took on the most powerful industry in the city, which is real estate, and, you know, forced these things through. So that is going to be the mainstay of the actual cuts and the main driver of blue-collar construction jobs that will come from this package of bills. And then aside from that, there are new mandates and pieces of legislation encouraging green roofing, so either plants or wind turbines or solar panels on top of the roofs of buildings, or and in addition to that, some new loan programs that help the landlords to put renewable energy to use in their buildings.
Yeah, and as you said, big real estate is not happy at all about
this.
That's
when you know it's a good bill.
And can you talk a little bit about how advocates organized to make sure that these bills were not going to negatively impact low-income renters?
Sure. So this was actually a big point throughout the process. So I think it helps to kind of understand the history of this, which is, you know, the city has been trying to find a way to reduce emissions from big buildings for years now. It's long been understood to be the biggest source of emissions within the city. And it just kind of went nowhere. And then last summer, in August, a group called the Urban Green Council, which is sort of like a coalition of both environmental and housing groups and real estate developers, came together and agreed upon a framework that would ideally, you know, work its way into legislation like this. And from the get-go, you know, you had buy-in both from the activists who were pushing for this and from the industry itself. Now, when that actually became a piece of legislation months later, by November, it actually was a much more ambitious package. It was something much more in line with what the climate and housing activists wanted, and much more aggressive than what the real estate lobby had wanted. But they were kind of already on board with it from the get-go. So during the process, there was a big fight over a carve-out that the lawmakers made for any buildings that have a rent-regulated building or a rent-regulated unit in it. Rent-regulated units, which are obviously really important for low and middle income people in New York, and to help to prevent rents from being jacked up arbitrarily by landlords. You know, it's a real dwindling stock of them. You know, there used to be millions, now there's about 990,000 left in the city. So it was really important that whatever this mandate was didn't require landlords to make the kinds of retrofits on the buildings that would allow, under the rent regulations that exist right now, for landlords to circumvent that and jack up the prices anyway. So there's a rule in the rent regulations that says basically that any investment that the landlord has to make that go past a certain level could potentially be passed on in the form of a pretty big rent hike of 6% or more. So this was a big sticking point, and you know, throughout the process, the activist groups, namely the group New York Communities for Change really pressed hard and managed to preserve that loophole for rent-regulated buildings.
Anytime you can, like, organizers can take on and defeat big real estate in New York is historic. I mean, as you're explaining, as we talked about on the show last week, real estate really owns New York, and they really run people out of their homes, 100 people a day. So when you fight them, it's always a historic victory. But in the broader context of climate policy, like, how historic is this bill, and can it be a model for other cities?
It's certainly historic, absolutely, from the perspective that you're noting, which is, you know, it's a real David versus Goliath accomplishment for the people that were pushing for it. But, you know, it's historic for more than that. I mean, this bill really has no precedent in any large city. The closest thing to it is a cap and trade program that Tokyo put in place for some of its large buildings, which is far less ambitious and a lot more complicated and therefore difficult to replicate. This goes much further. It is billed by many of its proponents, and I haven't found anyone to debunk this point yet, that, you know, it is the single largest legislative mandate for carbon reductions in any big city in the world. And, you know, at the risk of sounding a little bit too much like a hometown elitist as a native New Yorker, you know, what happens in New York tends to get replicated in other places. You know, even when Mayor de Blasio enacted his, went ahead with a lawsuit against big oil and started pushing for divestment of the city's pension funds from fossil fuels back in early last year, you know, that actually really helped push a bunch of other cities to do the same thing in the months that followed. So the hope, I think, is that this legislation will be copied by, you know, everything from cities within the United States, like Los Angeles or Philadelphia, but also abroad. You know, New York is kind of in that elite subset of global cities, and, you know, the policies that are enacted here aren't just a model for other American municipalities, but also places like London and Shanghai and Paris.
If you can make them cut emissions here, you can make them cut them anywhere, I guess.
Well, yeah, we are the financial capital of the world, and I really like the idea that some of these big banks that are actually funding pipelines and stuff, and their big, you know, tall buildings down on Wall Street now, are going to be the ones carrying the burden and not low-income folks for reducing these emissions. So you've been covering, you know, climate change, you know, not just here in New York City, but across the country and the world. In the last year, or I guess even really in the last, like, 6 months, you know, since Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Sunrise really put this idea of a Green New Deal on the map, how has that changed, you know, the national story on climate change?
I changed it in a huge way. I mean, it would be hard to overstate the impact that it's had. I mean, for a really long time, I think people understood climate change to be a really bad problem, but all of the solutions to that problem were pretty unexciting and difficult. You know, it's like being told that you have, some type of ailment, and the solution is only to eat, you know, vegetables that are neither appetizing nor interesting to cook into anything. So, you know, you have, it was kind of all these carbon pricing schemes, and, you know, how do we put the exact right price on carbon, and what kind of tax would we have to do, and what kind of cap and trade program would be good. And all of these things were neither popular nor really efficient at this point in time. I mean, they may have worked to reduce emissions in line with what we need to preserve a habitable climate for future generations if we had done them in the 80s, but that time has really passed. So, you know, the climate debate was a really static one. And, I mean, anyone who, you know, reads anything or looks at the internet or is vaguely aware of politics should know that, you know, the climate debate
has basically come down to, is science real or not, which is a really simplistic way of talking about a really complicated threat. It's also a really easy way for Democrats, being the party that believes in science, quote unquote, to, you know, avoid making any kind of uncomfortable decisions about policies that would actually, you know, hurt the industries that are propelling us toward climate catastrophe while still getting kudos for, you know, being pro-climate politicians. So, you know, the emergence of the Green New Deal changed all of that. You know, it is both a policy that is in line with, or, you know, is on the scope of the kind of crisis that the scientists say that we're facing. You know, it's the first thing that is actually on the scale of what needs to happen and how the economy needs to be transformed in order to adequately reduce emissions. But it's also exciting, you know, it's more than just, hey, we need to figure out how to put a price on carbon and this might affect, you know, how you have to budget your life if you're, you know, a working class person. And instead of saying, hey, look, you know, maybe the opportunity down the road after, you know, if you're someone who is living in a part of the country where there are few job prospects outside of, you know, being a cashier at Walmart, or, you know, if you've watched your parents, as I have, you know, struggle in industries and face layoffs over and over again. It's saying that, hey, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this country to save ourselves. And here's a program that might actually provide the funding that will make those things possible and will change people's lives in a positive way, which to me, as a regular person, certainly sounds like a more exciting thing than, you know, your airline tickets are about to become a lot more expensive.
Like, it's like after decades of, like, this notion that there is no alternative with the Green New Deal and in the broader movement that it's a part of is, like, putting into the mainstream, like a better world is possible. Like, yeah, we face these crises, but it's a chance to really transform things for the better for working people. We don't need more austerity. We need, like, more power in these communities.
And thank you so much, Alex, for all the writing you've done on this. If people want to follow your work, where can they find you?
Unfortunately, too often on Twitter, where my handle is Alex C. Kaufman, KAUFMAN, or you can find my work on HuffPost.com.
Well, thank you so much for being on today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, everybody should check it out. Alex wrote a really great piece called Puerto Rico is the Best Argument for a Green New Deal. It really looks at this on a very international level and kind of the results of neocolonialism that's happening today. So we've got about 10, 15 minutes left, so we'd really love to hear from you again out in the audience. This is Revolutions Per Minute, our Earth Day special on WBAI. So please call in. Our number is 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877, and we're talking about a Green New Deal and owning our own energy, which is something I'm really excited about. I think it's one of the things that we haven't heard enough about in a Green New Deal, but that really the people could own their own energy is really this revolutionary, exciting thing. And we've got a caller on the line. You are now live on WBAI.
Yes, good evening. Good show you guys got going there. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
And thanks for the compliment.
Listen, I think the whole thing that we guys have to start tackling is this edification of the corporations. The whole idea that we can't control things because corporate power has controlled our governments, our structures, the institutions and agencies set up to supposedly ride their worst wishes have become basically their clients. They seem, you know, some of the reports that you read, these agencies, various agencies, they report to the people that they see the companies and the corporations they're supposed to oversee as their clients. And the whole idea of corporations is you know, I don't know if you remember back in the financial crunch there in 2008, 2009, CNBC was pushing this whole thing about, well, corporations have to make money for their shareholders. That's the number one supposedly article that's written in corporations. And that's a falsity. That is actually a falsity.
Well, thank you so much for the call. I mean, there are certain like corporate laws that force, and the way the market operates, corporations have to organize themselves for profit. And even if they didn't have to, they will, because it's about their own power and wealth. But I appreciate the perspective, and I think challenging corporate power and organizing against it is really the key. We've got a bunch of callers coming in, so we want to welcome a new caller onto the line. You're live on WBAI. What's your question? How's it going? Hey, you're live. Hey, you're live.
Yes, hi there. Earlier in the program, in the beginning of the program, you spoke about the IWW, the International Workers of the World.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And the exactly. It was towards the beginning of the program. And I highly, highly recommend a book for the audience. You might know it yourself. It's called Rebel Voices by Joan Kornblau, and it is a anthology of the IWW.
Well, thank you so much for that suggestion. I think everyone should definitely check that out and learn more about the IWW and their really radical mode of organizing and the changes that they affected in this country in empowering working people. I think we've got another caller live on WBAI. Hey, you're live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your question and how you doing?
Hi. I wanted to know what he was referring to when he said there's jobs for the New Deal, the Green Deal.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?
Like, what kind of jobs was he referring to involving the new Green Deal?
So with the Climate Mobilization Act, a lot of that work is in energy efficiency, right? So that right now, one of the reasons we use so much energy is because it's just leaking really throughout the entire system. So this is things like retrofitting windows, and that's supposed to create thousands of jobs here in New York. I mean, we also need people eventually putting things like wind turbines in the ground. We need people installing solar. And so, and also one thing that's really important, I think, about a Green New Deal is that these, in the resolution, it's proposed that these are good-paying, dignified union jobs. So, and currently, fossil fuel jobs are poisoning workers. I mean, workers doing fracking are being exposed to benzene. So these are jobs that don't poison communities and will be good-paying union jobs.
And I think also critically is that like care work, like healthcare work, education work, is carbon neutral, and that like the struggles you see going on there, they're like fighting for a society that values their work because it's the basis of the world we live in. We could not do anything we do without the incredible work and dedication of teachers and nurses. And so I think, and also I just want to shout out the Stop and Shop workers. Service workers provide a lot of value, and we still will need people on the front lines there struggling too. But yeah, there's so many jobs that could come out of a Green New Deal. Also, like agricultural jobs, shifting from an agribusiness model to a more communal owned model. Like even just building parks in our cities, there's so many opportunities. And the original New Deal also, there was funding of art, and there was this real amazing growth of theater productions and movies and murals all across the country that transformed the way people see the world. So there's so much opportunity to create really great jobs, better jobs, and also jobs that have people spending less time at work, getting paid more for that work, and having more free time to enjoy the world, which is what we all really want at the end of the day, right? But I think we do have another caller live on WBAA. Hey, you're on Revolutions Per Minute. How's it going? What's your question?
Oh, great. Yeah, my name's Les Jameson. Great show. I love the fact that there's so much effort and activism happening here locally, and I want to bring up a very concern that's happening locally, which is the Con Edison imposition of smart meters everywhere throughout the city. They're already throughout Staten Island and Brooklyn and parts of Manhattan, and of course 5G towers coming soon. And I think it's very much connected with energy activism in the city. And I've just recently gotten notices for my house in Brooklyn where they're putting in the smart meters and opting out. People can opt out, but they charge a fee of $9.50 a month. And there are many, many other issues. Of course, the health hazards and there just needs to be some very, very urgent organizing done. I'd like to give an email, my email out, to see if anybody's interested in lobbying city council, state representatives. There is a bill called S-1618 dealing with this issue, but it's in committee and needs to get vote. Things of that nature. Would it be okay to give my email?
Yeah, of course. Just share that quickly. Thank you so much for sharing this with people, and it's definitely important for people to be out there and organizing. What's your email? Because we just want to get to our last couple callers.
Sure. It's no to smart meters and 5G at gmail.com. That's no, the number 2, smart meters and 5G at gmail.com. And appreciate anybody's interest in helping to organize, and this is a huge issue environmentally, health-wise, and politically.
Thank you so much for sharing, and thank you for organizing. We've got another caller live. You're on Revolutions Per Minute. How's it going? What's your question?
AOC's Green New Deal is unattainable communist bullshit.
Well, there goes our first reactionary caller of the day. Maybe you should do a little research into history and see also how capitalism is actually unsustainable. And I would use that term, but I think we'll get hit by the FCC. I think we've got all right. So our last call of the day was our worst, but we had plenty of really great calls. And before we wrap up, we just want to give people the opportunity to get involved in organizing, involved in the political process, involved in fighting for the Green New Deal, both nationally but locally, building worker power. So can you share with us the best possible ways for people to get plugged in?
Yes, you can go to our website, publicpower.nyc, and there is a sign-up information to get involved. We need people helping to do research. We need people helping to do communications, outreach, helping get the canvassing operations up and running. And also, if you're looking for a bit of a lighter lift, is we are looking for canvassers. We will be canvassing the Flatbush area, calling for more public hearings, and that is going to be next Sunday, the 28th, and that will be happening from 2 to 5. We have an Action Network link on the website that you can use to sign up, and we'll get you more information about that. If you never canvassed before, we will have trainings, and we'll be pairing you up with an experienced canvasser, and we will have talking points and everything. So if you're new to canvassing, like Alice was at the beginning of this segment, we would love to have you.
Sounds amazing. Lee, do you have anything you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just also encourage people to get involved in stopping the Williams pipeline as well, because that's a really big fight we have. So if you want a little more information on that, you can go to www.stopthewilliamspipeline.org. This has been Revolutions Per Minute, special Earth Day episode on WBAI. You can follow us anytime on Twitter at NYCRPM, and make sure you tune in tomorrow for our regularly scheduled RPM at 5 o'clock. This has been Revolutions Per Minute.